This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up in our upper left-hand corner. I'm Dan Daniels. Republican incumbent Congressman Virgil H. Good Jr. and Democratic challenger Tom Perriello spoke at a Senior Statesman of Virginia event held August 13, 2008, at the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Following opening statements by the candidates, questions were taken from members of the audience. Senior Statesman, Board Member, and Treasurer Bob McAdams moderated the program.
Good afternoon. The format of this forum is that we're going to have the two candidates each have 15 minutes, up to 15 minutes, for introductory remarks. Then we will be taking your questions, as Marvin has explained. I will be reading the questions. You can direct the question to one candidate or the other candidate or to both. They will have 2 minutes to respond, and the other candidate will also have 2 minutes to respond. They don't have to use the whole time. After the conclusion of approximately 50 minutes of question and answer, each candidate will have 5 minutes for their closing remarks. Now, I can sense the energy in this room. I can feel it radiating from you. But I want to advise you that there is no applause meter. And we want to discourage competitive clapping. At the end of the proceedings, we will allow ample time for everyone to clap and stomp and cheer and thank these candidates for their hard work. So we will proceed now, and I will have a brief introductory biography for each of the candidates. Tom and Virgil, if you want to come up to the stage. Tom Perriello is the Democratic candidate for the 5th District congressional seat. Tom was born and raised in the 5th District. Tom is the youngest of four children of Vito and Linda Perriello. Tom was an Eagle Scout in the Stonewall Jackson Area Council and was taught by his parents that to whom much is given, much is expected. And those lessons have shaped his lifelong commitment to service. After attending Albemarle County Public Schools and graduating from St. Anne's Belfield, Tom received his undergraduate and law degrees from Yale University. Upon graduating from law school, Tom was called to work to end atrocities in the West African countries of Liberia and Sierra Leone, which had suffered long civil wars fueled by blood diamonds. Tom's work with child soldiers, amputees, and local pro-democracy groups in Sierra Leone played a significant role in the peace and reconciliation process that ended 12 years of violence in that country. Tom then became special advisor and spokesperson for the international prosecutor during the showdown that forced Liberian dictator Charles Taylor from power without firing a shot. After his success, Tom served as a national security analyst for the Century Foundation and has worked inside Darfur and twice in Afghanistan. Since 2004, Tom has founded faith-based organizations in this country that are credited with shifting the national debate about America's moral priorities. He helped found faithfulamerica.org and Catholics in Alliance for the Common Good, which bring together faith communities to fight for children's health care, raising the minimum wage, and responsible solutions in Iraq. Inspired by the prophetic vision of Dr. King, Wilberforce, and Micah, Tom believes that America must reverse the erosion of our commitment to the common good and restore our understanding that our nation rises or falls together. In his bid for Congress, Tom recently completed a successful economic revival tour through all 22 counties and municipalities of the 5th District, in which he outlined his 7-point plan for bringing jobs and economic relief back to Southside and Central Virginia. He has 7 campaign offices throughout the district, and his campaign has logged more than 5,000 volunteer hours. His campaign workers have also tithed nearly 500 hours to local charities, including right here at the Senior Center. Through their unique volunteer tithing initiative, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee recently added Tom's campaign to its Red to Blue program, indicating that it is one of the most competitive races in 2008. That's Tom Perriello. Congressman Virgil H. Good Jr. is a lifelong resident of Franklin County and currently resides in Rocky Mount, Virginia. He is married to the former Lucy D. Dodson and has a daughter named Catherine. Congressman Good completed his undergraduate studies at the University of Richmond, where he received his Bachelor of Arts degree in 1969. While a student at the University of Richmond, Congressman Good was inducted into the Phi Beta Kappa and Omicron Delta Kappa honor societies. Following his graduation from the University of Richmond, Congressman Good attended the University of Virginia School of Law, where he received a JD in 1973. During that time, he was selected for the Virginia Law Review. In 1973, at age 27, Congressman Good was elected to the Commonwealth of Virginia Senate. He served as the 20th District Senator in the Virginia General Assembly until 1996, when he was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives, serving the 5th District of Virginia. He was sworn into office in the 105th Congress in January 1997, and has served continuously since then. Tom has been a recipient of the Superhero Award given by Community Health Centers. Virgil has been the recipient of the Superhero Award by Community Health Centers for legislative efforts on behalf of healthcare centers to serve the underinsured and the uninsured. Congressman Good now divides his time between serving in the U.S. House of Representatives in Washington, D.C., and being in the 5th District. He serves on the House Appropriations Committee and the Subcommittee on Interior and Environment, and also the Subcommittee on Transportation, Housing, and Urban Development. Virgil Good. At this time, we will have the introductory statements by each of the candidates. The challenger will go first, and the incumbent will go second. So, Tom Perriello.
Bob, do you want me up here or down there? All right. Thank you so much, everyone, for coming in the middle of the day. I know that this is a warm day and a summer day, and the showing is just tremendous. And this has really been true for us throughout our campaign. The outpouring of support and enthusiasm has really touched me throughout this process. I particularly want to thank the Senior Statesmen, a wonderful organization. I know how much work goes into putting something like this together. It's such an important part of our democratic process. Marvin Hilton and others who had to hear some back and forth and other things, and you persisted and got a great debate together, so I want to thank you for that, and Bob for your moderating. I also want to thank one member of the Senior Statesmen that's no longer with us who's been very important to our campaign, and that's former Delegate Mitch Vanieres. I had the tremendous honor of being a page for Mitch Vanieres when I was in the 8th grade and went to Richmond, and he was the first person who made me believe that you can enter politics and hold on to your integrity and continue to be a straight talker. He was the first member of my advisory committee for this campaign, and I know his spirit remains in this place, so I thank him for all of his wisdom throughout this process. It's very special to me for our first debate to occur here in the Senior Center, because this building and this organization were so incredibly important to my grandparents, Tom and Reba Galluli, in their late years. On the way in here, I spent a little time out on the two trees that are planted in their honor outside and the plaques in front. When they could no longer keep up the farmhouse, they moved a couple of blocks from here. And this was the group they went to visit the Peaks of Otter with, the group they talked politics with. My grandmother was the chair of the Financial Investment Committee here and really enjoyed that. It meant so much to her. And I learned so much from them. You know, my grandfather, Tom, whose name I carry forward, was to me the epitome of the greatest generation. He was a World War II veteran, but that wasn't enough. He was also a volunteer fireman. He was a high school math teacher, and he was a coach. And every morning, he would take me, and we would put up the flag together, and he would talk about the sacrifices of the greatest generation. And he always taught me that everyone's responsible for taking care of themselves, but it's what you do for your community and your country that will define you. There's so much that we do to honor the greatest generation in the books that have been written and the movies that have been made. But at the end of the day, the greatest way to honor the greatest generation is by reviving a kind of American politics worthy of the sacrifices that they made. The generation that were the children of that generation tried to change things through government. And in many ways, those programs caused as much harm as good. I come from the generation that are the grandchildren of that. And what we took from people like Tom and Reba Galluli was the sense that we had that same commitment to country and to community, but that the best way to do it was to go out and just do it ourselves. We felt like the way to change the world and the way to improve lives of our neighbors and our communities was through the nonprofit sector and houses of worship. Ours was a generation that didn't want to deal with all the mess and corruption of politics. In record numbers, our generation went out and volunteered. We did Teach for America programs in underserved rural and small town communities. We volunteered for Bridge Ministry programs, worked on humanitarian relief with at-risk kids. I myself felt the call to service that was instilled so early by my grandparents. I felt called after law school not to go the traditional corporate route, but to move to West Africa. I had spent the summer before working for the State Department. And at the time, Sierra Leone was considered the worst place on earth, and yet the Clinton administration had managed to make it even worse. This was a place where life expectancy was down to 34 years old, where 9 and 10-year-old boys were being forcibly recruited, drugged, and sent into battle. Ours is a generation that doesn't believe in sitting on the sidelines while these sorts of crises happen, whether it's in our community or across an ocean. This entire conflict was being driven by the dictator Charles Taylor, a dictator with far more links to Al-Qaeda than Saddam Hussein had. And we understand the interconnectedness of these conflicts and challenges we face today. And we don't want to sit around and wait for the politicians to continue to move us further and further behind, politicians from both parties who've dropped the ball. But what happened for me was, while I was able to witness tremendous change in the world, in Sierra Leone, within 8 months, we had gotten a peace deal that ended that civil war. And we did it without firing a single bullet. We were able to force the dictator Charles Taylor from power. And when I say we, it was tons of people working on it. There were regional governments, there were nonprofits, there were people in the private sector, there were war crimes tribunals that worked together because we did our homework to get this done. And I came back, and the challenges are right here at home as well. We're a generation that has continued to see job losses year after year, continued to see federal deficits go up year after year as we mortgage our future to China, as every child born today in the United States inherits $30,000 of U.S. federal debt. And what I found, was at the end of the day, these decisions are being made by politicians, and we can no longer leave politics to the corrupt. I would come back to Washington from Afghanistan to brief Republicans and Democrats, and all they cared about was how to use my information to make the other party look stupid. I would come back with fresh intelligence, and all they wanted to do was figure out how it could help with re-election instead of how to solve these problems. If there's one thing America should always be about, it's that solving problems and defending this country is more important than partisanship. When I saw the tide turning in Afghanistan, I didn't sit on the sides. I went in, and I tried to figure out strategies for victory. Same thing for the crisis in Iraq. Ours is a generation that doesn't really believe in partisanship. We don't believe in the old debates about liberal and conservative. We're a generation that believes in getting things done. And for us, when you're in the trenches, whether it's the trenches of Danville on economic development or the trenches in Afghanistan, the only thing that matters about the person next to you is whether they want to be part of the problem or part of the solution. We are ready to end a generation of failed politics that we've seen for the last 16 years, where each party seems more interested in how to make the other side look stupid. We have tremendous challenges right now. Previous generations have had to do things like storm the beaches of Normandy. We're being asked to be competitive in a global economy, to win the war against Islamist extremism, to become independent from fossil fuels, and to balance the budget. These are problems we can solve. We can solve them when we come together to make a difference. But year after year after year, we've been let down by Washington, the entire gang of them. It is so frustrating to see the people suffering around this district and around this country, suffering pain at the pump, pain at the healthcare and the pharmacy, talking to our troops in the field and returning home who feel like they've been let down by the political leadership, and to see the complete lack of creativity from both parties on figuring out how to solve these problems. That's why what we're doing with this campaign is a little different. We're focusing on a proactive agenda, and we're not waiting till we get to Washington to make the change. As Bob mentioned, we're out every week volunteering in the community, using our campaign to shine a media spotlight on those who are struggling and those who are innovating. We've already come up with a 7-point plan for economic revival, and I just got back from road testing it through all 22 counties in the district, talking to small business owners, people who are working, people who aren't working, chambers of commerce, economic development planners, people who are trying to give me the best and brightest ideas. Because I think for so long, the generation of politicians, whether it's Clinton or Bush, has been so scared that our best days are behind us that they're trying to stick to as much as they can instead of realizing the ever-expansive power of the United States, the ever-expansive potential. We have to have a new generation with the confidence that we can be secure, we can win global wars, and we can be competitive again, instead of thinking about how we try to figure out who to blame for the problem. And the model for this new generation of leadership, in my mind, was born right here in the state of Virginia. There is no better example of this type of get-or-done politics that puts results ahead of partisanship than former governor, soon-to-be Senator Mark Warner. Mark Warner has figured out how to work across the aisle to get the budget balanced, to get the state managed, and to start to get more education and vocational and skills training for people in the state. This is the kind of creative leadership that we need to bring to Washington. I've been to Washington. It's a wreck. Everyone up there, they're good people, but they still get caught up in a system that says we don't have it in us to solve these problems. It's not true. We do. There is nothing the United States can't do if we put our mind to it. But people are hurting right now. We need to figure out short-term solutions that help people with the pain they face. But what people want, people are so much more smart and decent than politicians give them credit for. People want long-term solutions. They understand that we need to look down the road for energy independence, for budget independence, and for a national security strategy that we can be proud of. For the first time in my lifetime, people are starting to believe that we can take that community service spirit that we got from our grandparents into politics, that we don't have to accept as a given that everyone up there is in it for themselves. Because this isn't just about the issues. Obviously, my top issue will be jobs and economic relief for Southside and Central Virginia, and that's what we're talking about on the trail. Obviously, we need to deal with the healthcare crisis, and we need a strategy in Iraq that both parties have dropped the ball on. But it's also about values. It's about restoring that greatest generation's idea that there is such a thing as service to country and service to community, not service to party. This is what I see as the possibilities before us. And I think what we need is a new wave, a new era of politicians who work as hard every day to bring back jobs and economic relief as the great people of this district are working just to keep food on the table and fuel in the tank. I was talking to a man in Pennsylvania County a couple of months ago. He'd just gotten off an 8-hour shift at the Walmart. He had about an hour off before he was going to work a 6-hour shift as a custodian. And he was talking to me about the double shift he had to work just to keep his family safe and fed. And as I drove away from there in my truck, I said, if everyone in this district is working a double shift, I make this pledge, I will work a double shift every day in Congress to bring jobs and economic relief. I will work a double shift in Congress every day to restore and revive the values of the greatest generation and make an American politics worthy of the American people. Because I tell you this, the next chapter of America's history hasn't been written yet. The next chapter of Southside Virginia's history hasn't been written yet. There is a path that is not a pretty one of more job losses, more despair, more drugs, more teenage pregnancy. But there is a path of a great blossoming of potential in Southside Virginia. There is a great path to a stronger America. The question is, will you join me in the next 84 days in rewriting the next chapter of American history? We have that power in this room. We have that power in this district. And this is what's been so frustrating to Congressman Goob, is that our campaign doesn't fit the last generation's ideas of liberal and conservative. There's an old playbook about this, but it doesn't apply to us. All we care about is how to get things done, how to serve our neighbor down the street, our neighbor across a county line, and our neighbor across an ocean. We're talking about a whole new era of politics that is going to restore that set of values, and that's why people across Southside are coming to our campaign. Evangelicals, veterans, young people, old people, who are saying it's not about rejecting anyone, it's just about moving on to a better kind of politics. That's what's so exciting. That's what's inspiring me in this campaign. That's what's made us a national target race. And we have 84 days to write a new chapter for Southside. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom. And now we will continue with the introductory remarks from Congressman Goode. If you have questions that you want to ask, raise your hand so that someone can pick them up and get them to our sorters for the questions. Congressman Goode.
Thank you very much. I, too, want to say words of appreciation to the senior statesman. I am grateful for the opportunity to work with Bob, Fred, Marvin, and others to bring this forum about. You've held this forum for the congressional race for many years, and I fondly recall in the off years being with you, with Congressman Bliley, when he represented part of Albemarle, and when I represented the southern part, and discussing issues. I've looked at your newsletter, and I know you're going to have State Senator Creed Eads. So you are keeping the citizens of Charlottesville, Albemarle, and this part of Virginia informed, and I am indeed grateful for that. Since Tom mentioned his grandfather, I feel it only appropriate to tell you that my father served in World War II, and he is part of that, he was part of that great generation, until the greatest generation, until he passed away. Like Tom, I believe in getting things done. But I can tell you, vague generalities will not win the day in Washington, D.C. You've got to have concrete proposals, and you've got to work on specific legislation. This this week and the prior week, I have been across the 5th District, touching all 22 jurisdictions, and will continue to do that between now and Election Day and thereafter. I have done that during my time in the U.S. House of Representatives, and I can tell you, touching base with citizens is the best way to find out what is on people's mind and in which direction this country needs to go. And I hate to tell you this, that in Washington, not everyone agrees. And after November the 4th, not everyone's going to agree. You're going to have to work on compromises and hopefully elect enough persons of a like mind that we can advance the agenda forward. I am one of those that for years have been focusing on the energy situation. I have favored drilling in Anwar and drilling in the Outer Continental Shelf because it is a way to have an immediate positive impact on fossil fuel cost. Now, I understand.
Each of these gentlemen with full respect. There will be no booing at this gathering. Please restrain from your applause until Congressman Good has had a chance to finish his remarks and we can go on to the questions. Thank you.
In Washington now, they're focusing on this issue, and I'm glad to say that presidential candidate Senator Barack Obama seems to be shifting. I also heard Speaker Nancy Pelosi just the other day talk to the issue, and she seems to be shifting. I am optimistic that we will be able to have a pro-drill, pro-conservative, pro-alternative energy policy that will keep energy costs low and will help the economy of the United States of America for all its citizens. There are other areas that are big before this Congress that we have been addressing, but on which there's no consensus. Immigration is a huge issue. And I believe that if the greatest generation were all living today, they would want some substantial changes in the wide open door policy that this country has now. I hear from veterans across the 5th District, and that's one of the things they bring up to me. They said, we fought for the United States of America, and we want the United States of America to continue forward. And let me say, I believe that the United States is a great country and will be a great country in the future if we build our future upon the values and foundations on which we were founded and on those principles which have made us great. Now, I'm not going to use the full length of my time because I know that you have many questions. And we were talking about this before the forum began. It's calculated that only 10 of you would get to ask questions. I hope by abbreviating my opening remarks that we will be able to listen more to you. And thank you for coming and participating.
Thank you. We are now going to begin the question and answer period, which will go on for about 50 minutes. We have a timekeeper, and there is a signal here. The candidates will see a yellow flag when there's 30 seconds left in their two-minute responses. The first question is directed to both candidates, and again, we will let the challenger begin. And here is the question, Mr. Perriello and Mr. Good. What is your position on climate change and global warming? What should be government policy on this issue? Mr. Perriello?
The issue of climate change and energy security is probably our number one national security threat, our number one environmental threat, and our number one economic opportunity. alternative energy and energy efficiency technology will be the dot-com boom of the next 20 years. 7 or 8 years ago, we were in the lead globally in these technologies. We have now dropped to 7 or 8 in this technology. That's because right now, the oil and gas companies can make more money by buying off politicians than by finding alternative fuels and energy efficiency technology. In 2008, my pickup truck gets 13 miles to the gallon. That is ludicrous. We have the technology right now to get 35 or 40 miles to the gallon. But the car companies can make more money buying politicians than building me a better truck. We need to be at the forefront of this. We are mortgaging our national security and our economic opportunity. But I will tell you this, we can't look at quick fixes. Now, I think there is some more drilling to be done. I don't think ANWR is the place to do it. I think we can look at a cost-benefit analysis. I think the states have made their decisions. But look at what's happened in the last 2 weeks. Oil prices have dropped primarily for one reason. Americans are driving less. Now, when I go around to the festivals all summer, the same ones Congressman Goud goes to, what I hear from people is, I haven't driven my truck in weeks. I'm riding to work in my wife's Toyota. The fact is, demand has dropped. The politicians have not done a thing. The Republicans blame environmentalists. The Democrats blame the oil executives, and nothing gets done. This is the same kind of thing we've seen from a generation of politics from both parties. We need an absolute and total commitment to energy independence in a generation. Thank you.
Global warming and climate change are issues that all countries need to address together. I am not for hamstringing the United States of America and having us adopt regulations or provisions of the Kyoto Treaty that would increase dramatically energy costs for the citizens of this country. I believe that countries around the world need to all get together and walk down the aisle together if you're going to adopt a lot of these restrictive policies. Because I can tell you, if you keep jacking up energy costs for the citizens of the United States, our standard of living is going to decrease. We're going to have higher food costs and higher negative impacts on our citizens in a number of different ways. And I disagree with Tom. I think having a pro-drill policy in ANWR would send a tremendous message. And I think, although I don't agree with President Bush on a number of issues, his removing the executive order moratorium that affected and impacted part of the west coast of Florida and part of the Gulf of Mexico has had a positive impact and is, although maybe minor, an impact on reduced fossil fuel costs right now, crude oil price per barrel, and the cost of gasoline, and the cost of diesel. And I am a big supporter of alternatives, and we'll blend that in when I have more time.
The next question is also directed to both candidates, and Congressman Goud will be the first to respond. Americans pay more per person for health care than in any other industrialized nation, but we get less. And 45 million Americans have no insurance at all. What should Congress do to fix this mess? Congressman Goud?
Well, first of all, I don't agree with the premise that the United States has a bad health care system. It needs improvement. But it's far better than most of the rest of the world, and I can tell you anecdotal story after anecdotal story of where persons come to this country from Mexico, where they have a socialized system, where they come from Canada to get immediate health care that they need. Now, I'm in favor of refundable tax credits to give greater opportunity to have more people insured. I also contest the 45 million people. There are about 12 to 15 million persons in the country illegally, and most of them don't have health insurance, and we could reduce that figure significantly if they weren't in the United States.
Is that the standard we're setting now, better than most of the world? Shouldn't America have the best healthcare system in the world and not just better than most of the world? The healthcare crisis in this country is not just the 47 million, however you count it, who don't have healthcare. It's also the 250 million of us who are paying too much, having to jump through too many hoops, and not getting enough service at the end of the day. The administration costs, the litigation costs, the HMO costs that have come into this, not to mention the prescription drug costs. You were the deciding vote saying we shouldn't be able to negotiate cheaper drug prices with the drug companies for seniors. You pay about 50% more in Medicare than you do with the VA hospitals. This was part of a $600 billion handout to the drug companies. Now, anyone who thinks that the healthcare system in this country is working is probably on the kind of healthcare that members of Congress get instead of the healthcare that the rest of us get. Now, one other thing. I don't think there's a perfect plan out there. I think we've got to come together to get a plan that brings down costs and expand coverage. One common sense solution, heavily supported by the Virginia Academy of Pediatrics, is the SCHIP program. The SCHIP program makes sure that children of working families get support to have health care. This is for the people working their way out of poverty, making just a little too much to get Medicaid, but not enough to be able to afford health care. We're punishing people for trying to move off out of poverty and into workfare. This doesn't make any sense. 30,000 children in Virginia today would have had health care if that program had been able to go through and Congressman Gut opposed it. Health care is a travesty in this country. We have got to figure out the right combination of public sector, private sector, and nonprofit work to get this solved. We're going to do it by bringing the parties together and finding a solution that gets every American access to a doctor they can afford.
Now, remember, you're supposed to be showing a little restraint here so we have more time for questions. Yeah. This question is directed to both candidates. So Mr. Perriello will answer first. Would you vote to extend the tax cuts of 2002 and 2003?
I would vote to protect all tax cuts as small as they were for the middle class and for small business. The only tax cut in the last 7 years that's targeted the middle class is the economic stimulus package that I supported and Congressman Gut opposed. Now, I don't think the economic stimulus package made sense because it would stimulate the economy. I think it made sense because it's the first tax break to actually go to the middle class. And I knew how much pain people were in trying to make it through heading into the summer driving season. So I think what we need is to realize that the real group getting squeezed right now is the middle class and small business. And I think it's particularly true when we remember that two-thirds of job growth in Southside Virginia comes from small business. It's great if we can bring out a 3,000-employee factory, but two-thirds of the job growth is from small business. So many small business owners take great pride in providing health care to their workers, but they're getting crushed. If we can help to give a little tax break to small business in the middle class, I think that's the right thing to do. But we've got to be fiscally responsible as we do it. The Republicans keep running up these huge deficits, and the Democrats have to come in and clean up the wreck. We've seen this. This is the strangest thing. I mean, you know, I grew up, in the Reagan era, right? So here we are. 70% of the federal debt has been run up by Republican presidents. Now, they've had plenty of help for Democrats in Congress. I'm not about to defend the Democrats on this. But what we've seen is both parties have an atrocious record on anything to do with balancing the budget. Congressman Gut often raises issues of our national sovereignty. There are few national sovereignty threats right now greater than the fact that we are mortgaging our future to China. We have got to get our budget balanced. I've worked in a lot of different countries around the world. I haven't worked in one yet that thinks stealing from your children is morally okay. But that's what Congress does every day. It's got to stop now.
I really like what Tom had to say about holding the line on spending. The debt stimulus package cost you $135 billion in borrowed money, and you're right, I voted no on it. They're borrowing the money primarily from the Chinese to pay with borrowed money, and that is, as he says, a cost for future generations to bear. I'll also point out his error in the previous statement he made. I support SCHIP as it stands now, not the huge expansion that was in the bill that the Democrats pushed for. I'll also comment about the health care for the members of Congress. I've introduced a bill that would allow anybody in the United States, except those in the Federal Employees Health Benefits Plan, which I'm in now, and which most members of Congress are in, and the President and the Vice President. We would have a separate health plan, and anybody could join it and pay the same rates that the members of Congress pay. So I'm for everybody having access to the same health care that coverage, insurance-wise, that the members of Congress have.
Does that come with the $200,000 salary?
Let's continue with the next question, if you're completed, Congressman Good. Are you finished?
Okay. He said that he was not in favor of the Bush tax cuts. I supported the Bush tax cuts. They helped many in the middle class. It increased the child tax credit. That benefited countless families across this country. It basically eliminated the marriage tax penalty. Do away with that, and we'll go back to having a penalty for being married, and having a child will be more costly from a tax viewpoint. Those were good advantages. I also think the lower capital gains rate encourages business and investment, which means jobs in Southside, jobs in Central Virginia, and jobs over throughout the United States. And I support a lower capital gains tax rate, and I think it's good for the overall economy.
The next question is directed to Tom Perriello. Do you support President Bush's position supporting Democratic Georgia in the war with Russia?
The crisis in Georgia is one that comes in part from 7 years of taking our eye off the ball with Russia. We have a very short attention span in both administrations. We have seen the Bush administration repeatedly talk tough and negotiate weak. I'll give you a couple of examples from work I've done. With Musharraf in Pakistan, we give about $2 billion a year, $1 billion overt and $1 billion covert. And yet the Bush administration negotiates with them as if they hold all the cards. And we have continually gotten played like a fiddle. Clinton did too. But the point is, these guys do not know how to negotiate tough in Central Asia. Same thing is true in Afghanistan, where the Bush administration has thrown millions, tens of millions, at the warlords, only to see them turn into narco-trafficking thugs. The Afghans warned us over and over again, do not get in bed with the warlords. But they wanted to do it on the quick, and they did. They got bad intelligence because we have not supported our intelligence community, and we have not understood yet just how much we are going to win this war, in part as we did with the Cold War, with a strong intelligence community. When it comes to Georgia and Russia, we have a very complicated relationship with Russia. They remain a P5 member of the Security Council. We've got to remain in open dialogue with them. The threat of loose nuclear material from Russia and the former Soviet republics is an extremely serious threat. The aggressive moves by Russia into Georgia were clearly an overreach based on a semi-legitimate claim in terms of the sovereign areas within Georgia. What we have to have is a comprehensive foreign policy that puts America in the position of ultimate strength in these negotiations. The Bush administration has stretched our military thin. It hasn't supported our intelligence community, and Republicans and Democrats on Capitol Hill have sat by and let it happen. We need people who understand this struggle and don't keep trying to apply the rules of Cold War to this one. We need to support our intelligence community, and we need to hold Russia accountable. Thank you.
One lesson that we can learn from this is that Russia, after the Berlin Wall fell and after we saw the breakup of the Soviet Union, said, we are going to be energy independent. We are going to drill, we are going to get our own resources out of the ground, and we are going to improve our economy. And they have done that. They are energy independent now. They have their fossil fuel sources and are using them and other sources. The United States, for it to be a strong negotiator with Russia, needs to be energy independent so they can't cut us off over in the Middle East or any other place. And that's why I am pro-drill and pro-energy independence in this country. If we do that, we'll be in a much stronger negotiating position.
The next question is directed to both candidates, and so Congressman Good will respond first. Do you think earmarks are a good way to allocate public funds?
We've had four votes in Congress to end all earmarks in particular bills. Campbell of California had two, and he was sincere with his proposal. I voted for both of Campbell's proposals last year to end all earmarks in two specific appropriations bills. We didn't even get 60 votes on either one. Dave Obie put, we'll take out all earmarks in labor, H, and education, which would have cut out the earmark for JABA that they got. And the University of Virginia would cut that one out, too. But I voted to get rid of all of them. Now, I'm not for picking and choosing. I'll vote to get rid of all of them because we need to balance the budget. And I voted for Obie's amendment. Of course, he didn't even vote for his own amendment. But again, I don't even think you cracked 100. We had a vote to get rid of earmarks this year. One vote, because we've only had one appropriations bill on the floor, because that's the only one Nancy Pelosi would let on the floor. 63 voted to end all earmarks. I voted to end all earmarks.
Now, we always have problems of supply and demand, and what I have run out of is the supply of questions, please.
I do need to respond, by that way, Bob. While those questions roll in, let me say a couple things about earmarks. Earmarks aren't going away. Everyone gets them. I'll probably be able to get more as a member of the majority party, but you shouldn't have to choose between getting earmarks and supporting policies that leave the working class and the middle class behind. Earmarks are the sort of lowest hanging fruit of politics. But what we've seen in this district is 15,000 job losses. What we've seen is healthcare costs and gas prices tripling in the time that Congressman Good has been in office. So what we're seeing with this is a distraction from the continuing deterioration in the district, a great district that's ready to turn around. Let me tell you where earmarks work and where earmarks are a problem. I think the earmark that Congressman Good got for switchgrass in Gretna was a good thing. But then he voted against shifting subsidies away from the oil and gas companies and onto alternative energy. Congressman Good has now answered three times about energy independence, but he has a 0% rating on his votes for energy security and energy independence, a 0% rating. Now, in addition, he has never voted for an energy plan that would not make the oil and gas companies more money. He has $200,000 personally invested in oil and gas companies. He's taken $100,000 in contributions from big energy and big oil, and every single one of his votes makes them more money. Now, I'll tell you, I actually think there's more drilling to be done. I'm going to lose some people here. I think we need to expand nuclear. We have to throw everything in the kitchen sink at energy independence. But what we see is an earmark to Gretna, but then voting against the very things that could turn that into a great economy that could transform that district. That's when earmarks make no sense. People in Southside don't want to hand out, they want to hand up. People want to work. They want to make a decent living, and they want the kind of economic turnaround we can see. We haven't seen it. There's been amazing work in cities like Danville at the local level and the state level, where Warner and Kane have shown great leadership, Sherman Saunders and others. There's so much hard work being done there. We need the kind of things that will transform our economy and truly make this country energy independent. Thank you.
This question is directed to both candidates, so Mr. Perriello will answer first. What should be the U.S. policy on Iraq?
This is one where I haven't sat on the sidelines. I've been working since 2006, to push both parties for asking the right questions. The generals on the ground, Petraeus and others, have made it very clear. The primary problem in Iraq is political. In this country, we talk about more troops or less troops because it works for our politics, but it doesn't work for our generals on the ground. The question is, are we moving towards a new power-sharing arrangement that fixes the mistakes the Bush administration made? Now, I opposed the war from the beginning. It was the wrong war at the wrong time, but I also opposed timelines for pulling out. The key is whether we can reengage the Sunnis and the Shia that are not aligned with Iran to bring them back to the table. We also have 2 million refugees in the area who we have a moral and strategic responsibility to. The fact is, we need people who understand how to fix this war. The Republicans and the Democrats on Capitol Hill sat by and let this happen. We cannot walk away from this. We have to solve it right. Every single person in Washington has dropped the ball on making this work. We're seeing a turnaround there. It's not because of the surge per se. It's because Bush went out and started to do deals with al-Sadr and the others there. That's what the intelligence community had been telling him to do all along. So we continue to have a debate in the United States and Capitol Hill that is totally disconnected from the reality on the ground. I will stand up to any Democratic president or any Republican president who continues to fail to provide a strategy for winning and getting us home in Iraq. That's the solution.
To clear up something that Tom just said, I had a 0% rating. By whom? People rate you all the time. I got a zero probably with Planned Parenthood and 100% pro-life. I don't even know what group he's talking about. He should tell us which group he's talking about. And when he says I voted against the energy bills, I voted against energy bills that increase taxes and decrease the effort to bring more energy from domestic resources into this country. I fully support alternatives, support solar tax credit, wind tax credit, biofuels. You get $1 a gallon on that and between 45 and 51 cents for ethanol and tax credit like that, and I've supported those. For getting out of Iraq, I do not favor a dead set date to get out. I do want us to be free of Iraq, and one of the ways to do that is be free of foreign fossil fuel. I think it would help us immensely to not have the yoke of the Middle East around the United States. So I want to see us out of Iraq as soon as we can in a reasonable and responsible way.
The next question is directed to both candidates. Please So I think it is Congressman Good's turn to go first. The question is, please specify your proposals and beliefs about renewable energy.
Thank you. I also would want to mention that Tom indicated that every single House and Senate member had it wrong on Iraq, and I'm wondering if he's including his candidate for president, Senator Barack Obama, in that group. That might be a little overstatement, and he may want to correct it as we go through the timeline. On energy independence and alternative energies, I do support, as I stated previously, solar tax credits, wind tax credits, efforts to develop, particularly in Southside Virginia, the Switchgrass Project, which has gotten funding through the Land Grant University for the state of Virginia and for the Institute of Advanced Learning in Danville. That's a great project. It utilizes switchgrass, miscanthus, and wood products. Another project that's going on in the big city of Bassett Forks is going to have its grand opening on August 25th, and that's canola oil. Canola oil will be used in farm vehicles as a substitute for diesel. For on-road trucks and cars that are diesel, there will be a blend of canola and diesel. The company that's running that is going forward And I think that is an example of helping the agricultural economy in the 5th District of Virginia and in much of the rural parts of the United States. Another effort in Danville is the hybrid vehicle effort, AVCR, at the Institute, right near the city and in the county of Pennsylvania, where they will convert a vehicle from a gasoline only to a hybrid vehicle, and you can run the first 30 to 50 miles on electricity. And there's more, but that's a thumbnail sketch of three quick ones.
We need in the first 100 days of the next administration, whether that's an Obama or a McCain administration, a complete generational commitment to energy independence. The tax credits are a good thing, but we need a more comprehensive overhaul of supporting alternatives and energy efficiency technology. That includes the CAFE standards and other things. Nothing makes people more upset in Southside that I talk to than the fact that they're having to put so much fuel for so much cost in their trucks. This is crushing families right now. We need to think of this across the board. We need to reward conservation as well. As I said, some of the reason we're seeing the price coming down is because Americans are doing their part and driving a little less. Now, I'm not saying we should regulate that. We shouldn't. But most Americans step up to the plate. We saw that after 9/11. If on September 12th, President Bush had said to everyone, look, in the next 5 years, we're going to make this happen, Americans would have done it in a heartbeat, whatever it took. But we weren't asked by that. We didn't see that leadership from the president. We didn't see it from the Republicans. We didn't see it from the Democrats. The greatest generation would have used that moment to make this country stronger than it's ever been. Instead, we were told to go shopping. This was a lost opportunity, but it's not lost forever. That spirit is still inside each one of us as Americans, as Virginians, as citizens. We have within us the potential to do great things because we know what a challenge this is. And I think we see the same thing in Iraq. When it comes to your question, Senator Obama wasn't in Congress when the vote for the Iraq War came up, so it wasn't relevant. But I will tell you this, and I'll scale back to everyone. They're good people out there, whatever. But no one forced the Bush administration, and no one forced the mainstream media to ask the right questions. What we see is an intelligence failure because the intelligence community and the military were saying things, and the politicians weren't listening. You can hear all you want from officials in both parties saying we were listening to the generals on the ground, and it is a load of bunk. The fact is, they said you either don't go in or you go in strong. And the fact is, they also were saying this is not the place we want to go right now. This is the place Bin Laden wants us to go. But you don't cut and run. You get it right. You get it right there in Afghanistan. In Afghanistan right now, when I left a year ago, the top security experts said the insurgency in Afghanistan will be larger than the Iraq insurgency in 3 years if we don't get on top of the situation there. I don't care who the president is. I'm going to hold them to the fire to make sure we change our policy in Afghanistan and get on top of the threat from there.
The next question is directed to Tom Perriello. Over decades, the value of work has stagnated or declined. In the global economy, American workers are competing against impoverished people earning slave wages. What should Congress do to level the playing field?
It breaks my heart to drive around Southside and see how many good, decent people are trying to work hard and play by the rules and either can't find a job or find a job that they can't support their family with. People are working two, three shifts just to make the same kind of income they were before. When people who work hard and play by the rules can't make it, people stop working hard and playing by the rules. We do have a culture problem in this country in terms of the value we put on work, and we have an economic problem. And I think we can raise the minimum wage, but at the end of the day, we don't need a minimum wage, we need a living wage. And the government can't regulate that. What we can do is give people the skills and the education they need to enter the workforce and earn a living wage. The Danville Community College Machinist Program has a 100% hiring rate out of their machinist classes with an average starting wage of $27 an hour. Now, the problem is most of those jobs aren't in Southside, so they leave. And now our number one export from Southside is our most talented young people. We need to figure out living wage jobs there. And as I said before, it's not going to be a quick fix. We're not one earmark away from solving the problem. We're not one Walmart away from solving the problem. We have to do three things. We have to do workforce development, 21st century infrastructure, and support to small business. Because what we see is not the 3,000 employee shops coming in. We see, if we're lucky, a couple hundred, a lot of 25, 50-person shops. But when we give people the vocational and skills training that they need, then people can move down that line. No Child Left Behind, a policy that I'll give Congressman Goode's support for opposing, because it is something that's been choking out vocational and skills training program, life skills program, health programs, and other things that are so vital in our schools. If we give people the chance to get the training they need, to be a pipe fitter and a welder, and to become their own small business owner in 10 years, we can see the economy turn around, and we can be at the forefront of the new energy economy. I think that's the key for Southside Virginia.
On workforce training, I agree with Tom that that's an area that we need to work on, but we have been working on it. Southside Community College, with its campus at Alberta, Keysville, and a facility in South Boston, have been training truck drivers and forklift operators. They have jobs waiting for them in the economy as soon as they graduate. The retraining programs under the Trade Act have helped persons shift from manufacturing jobs in the textile area to healthcare jobs. They have jobs waiting for them in Southside. The programs at Danville Community College, which Tom mentioned, and at Patrick Henry Community College, have gotten federal funding for retraining and for focusing on jobs in the economy where these persons can go to work as soon as they get their degree. We are working in that area, and I want to thank the community college systems for doing that. Piedmont hadn't needed it to the same extent, but we have worked with Piedmont. But now let me tell you, regardless of how much job training you do and how much you focus on other aspects of keeping jobs manufacturing in the United States, you've got to change the pro-free trade policies that existed under Clinton and existed under Bush. And let me say, I disagree with both Clinton and Bush on that. The free trade is a way to shift manufacturing jobs to foreign countries. The wages are less. They don't have to worry about OSHA. They don't have to worry about the Employment Commission. They don't have to worry about EPA coming in. They don't have to worry about the Department of Environmental Quality. It's just a lot cheaper to produce and manufacture overseas. And I think we need to rethink totally this free trade policy and look at NAFTA and all the other free trade agreements. If we do that with an eye towards protecting the United States of America, it will help the job levels in this country.
The next question is directed to Congressman Goode. According to the Middle East Times of August 12th, quote, an impressive joint European and U.S. naval task force is heading for Iran, supporting the belief that a military strike against Iran is looming, close quote. Please comment on why you support Resolution 362 and would you agree that President Bush would be in direct violation of the Constitution if he goes ahead with sanctions and blockade without permission from Congress?
I don't agree with that last statement about sanctions and the blockade, but I do think Congress should be consulted, and it should be anything like that should be done, hopefully in a bipartisan manner, meeting with the Senate Majority Leader, Senator Reid, Speaker Pelosi, John Boehner, Minority Leader, and Mitch McConnell, Minority Leader, and others on the key committees like Senator Biden, and not have it as a one-partisan focus in dealing with Iran. I think whatever is done with regard to Iran should be bipartisan and have unanimity in the country and not have any go-it-alone policy.
We good? The threat from Iran is very real, and it has been exacerbated dramatically by the Bush administration. The fact is, we do need to realize the way this can destabilize a very dangerous region. But I don't know, the situation in terms of Ahmadinejad is one that goes back to what I was saying earlier. The Bush administration is constantly negotiating. It's just doing a really bad job of it. The way they handled the situation in Iraq was to super empower Ahmadinejad and those in Iran. Their hand has been strengthened, the way that he has overextended our military, etc. This is a real threat. But in the same way that he's had the wrong strategy in Afghanistan and Iraq, I think there is no reason to believe that President Bush will have the right strategy now. I think whether we look at a President Obama or a President McCain, one of the first things they are going to need to deal with is how to change our strategy with Iran to start weakening their hand rather than strengthening it. I do think that sanctions and other moves can be an important part of that. I think the EU and Russia are going to have to be part of that conversation, and we've seen some of that starting to go forward now. What we have to understand is how weak Ahmadinejad is domestically. He's weak in terms of the economy there and other things. And the saber rattling is something that keeps him strong. So we need to be smart about the way we engage and we negotiate in each of these situations. I think that the Republicans and the Democrats on Capitol Hill have spent too much time trying to angle for what's going to look good in a headline instead of angling for what's going to make this country safer. We need a smart strategy that understands that it's going to be on our intelligence community and our diplomatic corps, not our defense contractors, that end up winning the struggle we're in right now. Thank you.
The next question is directed to both candidates. Would each candidate please explain his position on a woman's right to choose in plain, unambiguous language? Congressman Good?
My position over the years has been clear. I'll just lay it out and you can understand it precisely. In the Virginia State Senate, I was a Democrat. And there were ratings given to you by the Virginia Society of Human Life. In the early 90s, it might have been as late as 94 and 95, there were two persons that had a 100% rating with the Virginia Society of Human Life. That was me, and believe it or not, another Democrat, Chuck Colgan. Now, I don't want to say that's anti-Republican. What it was, we'd been there longer than most of the Republicans, so we had a longer scorecard. And I'll have to say that Chuck Colgan, I see he made some of the Democrats mad in Richmond either this year or last year when he continued his pro-life voting record. In the United States House of Representatives, I have a 100% voting record with the National Right to Life. And I'm proud of that. And if I'm reelected, I'm going to continue to have a pro-life voting record.
The debate, well, I'll start with the answer, and then I'll explain why I think it's the wrong question to ask. I am, no, it's fair enough. I think that abortion is wrong personally, but I will uphold Roe v. Wade. I believe that there are common sense restrictions in late-term abortions, but I'll tell you this. There are 1.2 million abortions in this country every year, 1.2 million. I think that is a failure in terms of a culture of life and a failure in terms of empowering women. I think we have, coming from a post-Roe generation, I can tell you that what we look at is the terms pro-life and pro-choice being terms that help Democrats get elected and help Republicans elected. But we see pretty much nothing change on Capitol Hill besides a few things on the margins. With one of the great tragedies of our time, we see it treated as a political football. 1.2 million abortions in this year, I think, is a tragedy by any standard. I have worked on Capitol Hill bringing together 100% pro-life and 100% pro-choice members of Congress around something called the Abortion Reduction and Family Support Act, with the idea of aggressively reducing the number of abortions by 50% over the next 10 years. While both sides continue to fight about whether to criminalize abortion, and I have tremendous respect for people on both sides of that debate, the fact is it's not moving that debate forward. The fact is what we can do is figure out a way to promote a culture of life, to promote families, to promote pre- and postnatal care, and get serious about the things that may actually affect the lives and affect the number of abortions in this country. I think that's the right way for a new generation to go about having this conversation. It is a very, very difficult issue. I have tremendous respect for people on both sides. I think that's the way we move the debate forward. Thank you.
This next question is directed to both candidates, and so Mr. Perriello will go first. Discuss how the problem of illegal immigration should be solved.
You sure you want me first on this? The illegal immigration crisis in this country is serious. I think that there are those in my party who want it to go away. We have an idea in this country that there's certain jobs Americans won't do. I don't believe that. I think there's only a wage an American won't do that job for. And we need to decide whether we're serious and ready to start paying a better wage to Americans to do the jobs that we're currently subsidizing through illegal immigration. I do believe, as a person of faith, that we can have a debate about illegal immigration that is serious without dehumanizing our fellow children of God across whatever border they're across. I think what we look at when we take this problem seriously is this. I'm a pragmatist. How do we solve the problem? And we know that the number one strategy in terms of effectiveness for dealing with illegal immigration is holding employers accountable. As long as the jobs are here, there is no fence we can build high enough to keep people out. It's a $6 billion fence you'll get across with a $12 ladder, and we'll keep paying the defense contractors for it. As long as the jobs are here, people will go over it, under it, and around it to get here while their families are starving back in Mexico. If we want to get serious about this, instead of throwing billions of dollars at defense contractors, we need to go after the employers. Now, Congressman Gooden and I disagree about this. For all of his very strong comments about illegal immigration, he's actually voted repeatedly not to raise fines on the employers of illegal immigrants. I believe this is something where parties can come together to try to solve a difficult problem that has to be dealt with in order to make sure that the working class in this country has an opportunity to find jobs and work their way out of poverty. Thank you.
I don't know what Tom has been reading, but he is flat wrong. My bill that passed the U.S. House of Representatives would have increased the fine for hiring one illegal to $50,000 per illegal. I believe in employer enforcement. That alone is not going to do the job. And he doesn't understand the fence bill. He doesn't know what fence you're talking about. A $12 ladder will never even get near the fence that Duncan Hunter and myself proposed in the Hunter-Good legislation that passed the U.S. House of Representatives. It's a three-tier fence. Fence here, roadway here for the Border Patrol to go down. Barrier here, road here, fence here. They've had that between San Diego and Mexico. I think they may have gotten one tunnel, to my knowledge. And the last report I've had on it, they've never scaled that fence. They're not going to scale the fence. But Tom is right, some would go around the fence. The fence will help, won't solve the problem. You've got to do a multitude of things. First of all, I want illegal immigration totally stopped. Coming into this country without going through the background check, without being fingerprinted, without having the interview, we are opening ourselves up for a possible world of hurt by being lax against illegal immigration. What we need to do to start with is say no to the anchor babies. They come over here and have a kid. The kid's an automatic citizen. free food stamps, free Medicaid, free SSI, and we are paying for it all. Let's get the Democrats, which they won't do, to support that legislation. Makes no sense to give a reward to an illegal for coming to this country by pulling out the checkbook and giving them more. We've got to cut off the checks, and that'll help stop the flow.
The next question is directed to Representative Goode. This is in regard to the case before the Supreme Court, D.C. versus Heller. It's a Second Amendment case. The Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, upheld the right to handgun possession. Do you agree with this decision, and why?
I agree with the position and the decision that it is an individual right. I'm not sure about the dicta in the decision that may be interpreted in various ways to place restrictions on that right. But I am very glad that the United States Supreme Court in D.C. v. Heller said that I as an individual and you as an individual have the right to keep and bear arms. Now, I'm not sure about interpretations of that decision and what. For instance, the D.C. Council, soon as the decision was handed down, have put so many restrictions on handgun ownership that we now have legislation introduced by Mark Sider. And this is one thing where we're getting some Democrats to work on it. I can't remember the Democratic member. But to pass a federal law outlining your gun rights in the District of Columbia. And I am supporting that legislation. It's my belief that the gun groups, National Rifle Association, gun owners, they are supporting this legislation. It is not right, in my view, for a citizen of Washington, D.C. to be denied the constitutional right to protect him or herself.
I agree with Congressman Goode about the individual's right to bear arms. We can't pick and choose our amendments. I stand up for the Second Amendment with the same intensity I stand up for the First Amendment. I've spoken out against any infractions on that right in the same way I have about wiretapping, torture, and other issues. I think that what we need to deal with in this country, in my mind, is a serious agenda, though, about mental health. When I grew up around here, we thought mental health problems only happened to people in New York City. But the reality is it's happening with our young people, with our returning troops, and others. I think we need to grow up and take a serious look at helping to identify, support, and provide help to those who are suffering from mental health. I think that's an agenda we should be able to come together on, Republicans, Democrats, with a particular emphasis on veterans. So I believe in the individual right to bear arms, and I believe in an aggressive agenda on mental health. Thank you.
Our time for questions and answers is coming to a close. We will have one last question. This question is directed to both candidates, and it will go to Mr. Perriello first. Term limits for all legislators. Your thoughts?
I think that term limits are a very sensible solution to the problem of endemic corruption in Washington. I think it's a least best solution. There's a lot of experience and expertise from people who've been on the Hill for a while. And in a best case scenario, we would have good competitive districts that had not been gerrymandered. We'd have serious campaign finance reform. We would put a padlock on the revolving door to keep congressmen from leaving Congress and becoming lobbyists, making $1 million a year from the companies that they've just been regulating. If we deal with all those things, I think term limits aren't the same problem. But if we can't get those sorts of things done, we have got to figure out a way to rotate these people out. But the ultimate solution to term limits is what we have in 84 days, which is an election. We know that when we're on a level playing field in this race, we've got a better agenda, we've got a better message, we've got so much momentum. But incumbency has huge advantages. You've probably all gotten those great town hall calls that Congressman Goode does. That's constituent services, and I respect that, but I don't get to do that on the taxpayer dime. We have to go out and hustle, knock on doors, go to festivals. That's why we have 7 offices open. We have 30 people in the field knocking on doors. That's why we've been able to get so many volunteers and spread the word. So I think it's unfortunate that we have the kind of endemic corruption in Washington. I think term limits is the kind of solution we end up with because all of the other problems are there.
I respect your answer, Tom, but I would have to disagree about having the better message. I think we have the better message. On term limits, I'm a co-sponsor of a bill that says members of the House can serve 3 4-year terms, and the members of the Senate could serve 2 6-year terms. I'm the only one so far, but I voted for... When I was there, as a Democrat, I voted for term limits as they were proposed by Speaker Gingrich, and I supported them at that time, and I still support them. I would have to say that Tom's thought about getting every congressional district competitive is not going to happen. And the way to have turnover in Congress is to have term limits that apply across the board. Now, am I for an individual taking a term limit pledge? No. You're going to hurt your district doing that. I think the district would be, this district would be worse off if you have a new member that doesn't have the experience and not on the committee. But I think if you had across-the-board term limits, you would prevent situations like some Republicans and some Democrats that stay there for 40 and 50 years, and they are on the best committees. Charlie Rangel of New York is on chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, tremendous power and influence. John Dingell, been there for 50-some years, does a good job. And does a great job representing his district. He's helping it. But other districts don't have the same equity. So I think having a term limit, 3 4-year terms for members of the House is the way to go, and 2 6-year terms for the Senate. And I'm one of those that if they prohibited former members from being lobbyists forever, it's all right with me.
At this time, each of the candidates will have up to five minutes for closing remarks. And again, we will begin with the challenger and end with the incumbent.
Thank you all again for coming, for being patient, for largely behaving. We've had a lot of fun with this. This is our first forum, and I hope it will be the first of many and the beginning of a conversation over the next 84 days, because we really do want the voters to have plenty of exposure to what we each stand for and what our plans are for. I just want to say a couple of things in closing. The first is that Congressman Goode has made a couple of suggestions about his effectiveness in Congress. He's not ranked as one of the more effective members of Congress, and he talked in his very first comments to me about how the need for compromise is the key on Capitol Hill. Yet the people he backed for president, Hunter and Tancredo, I think had a combined vote in the Republican primary of about 0.4%. This isn't lining up with the mainstream of the Republican Party. This isn't building bridges across party lines. I think what we see here is the kind of politics we've seen with 8 years of Clinton and 8 years of Bush, which is people playing to the extremes in order to create paralysis instead of sitting down to get things done. Part of the reason earmarks come through is because nothing serious is being done to transform our rural communities and small towns. What we need is to be building those sorts of relationships across the country with other areas suffering in the way that Southside has been suffering. Because we do see signs of hope, and there has been leadership. This isn't about tearing anyone down or saying anyone's a bad person. This is about who is going to be able to go and do more on Capitol Hill for Southside and Central Virginia. I would not be running for this race if I did not know with confidence that I could do more on Capitol Hill for this district than Congressman Goode has done. The reality is he made a bet and switched the Republican Party, which at the time seemed like a very smart move in terms of power on Capitol Hill. But the fact was they're now out of power. I'll be going up as a member of the majority party, and that means that I'll be able to have more influence and be able to get more done there. But to me, this isn't just about what you can do for the district. This has to be about what you can do for the country. We stand as a nation right now at a crossroads. For a generation of politics, we haven't stepped up to face the challenges. We haven't lived up to that model of the greatest generation. We have an opportunity, and we need to take it now in the next 84 days to get the kind of leadership that will do something serious about energy independence, about the debt that we're sending overseas, about job growth and economic competitiveness in this country. What gets mistaken for leadership in Washington sometimes is being able to say something that sounds good rather than something that's going to get it done. I think that's what we've seen from the Bush administration more than anything else. What we need right now are problem solvers. It's not a coincidence that we're on the dawn of a new era of politics. The fact is, so many in my generation felt like we could change things either through private sector, because we could look at the bottom line, or through the nonprofit sector, because we could just go out and do it. We're going to bring that same spirit of problem solving, that Mark Warner spirit of reaching across the aisle to get things done. Because at the end of the day, there are things that are more important than getting reelected. There are things that are more important than getting reelected. And that's to do what's right for the district and the country. I think the definition of insanity is continuing to do the same thing and expect a different result. This is a time where we need to change the folks in Washington, change it up in order to change the kind of results we're seeing. That's the kind of leadership I plan to bring to Washington. That's the kind of leadership I believe this district deserves. I hope you will trust me enough to give me your vote so that I can go to Washington and work as hard for you as you're working for your family. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to say that I make no apology for making personal campaign contributions to Tom Tancredo, Ron Paul, and Duncan Hunter. If you want the illegal immigration problem solved, any one of those three would do the job. They would deliver the goods and carry the freight. And so I was glad to be for them. They didn't make the grade, but I'm not changing my position on it. And they do want me out of Congress. The liberal Democrats want me out. And they want me out because I'm a conservative voice. If we can silence that person, that's exactly what we want. We want more mushers up here in Congress that won't speak out and stand out. They want an Obama majority in this country. Tom is on the Obama majority list for the U.S. House of Representatives. They want to get him in there, because they know he is going to be voting with them. They want to control the White House, 60 votes in the U.S. Senate, and a strong majority in the U.S. House of Representatives. And you're going to have the highest tax increases in history, just like in the Democratic budget that passed. You will have a huge amount of new spending, like $845 billion, to carry out Obama's war against poverty in foreign countries. And I can tell you one thing, a lot of citizens in Southside Virginia are not going to be happy with the transfer of money to all these foreign countries. We've got too much foreign aid going on right now. Ron Paul is a no vote on that. Virgil Goode is a no vote, and so is Tom Tancredo. And what we need, rather than fewer of those persons in Congress, we need more of these people in Congress who will say no to busting the budget and blowing money.
Okay. Now, you've been good so far. Now, what I would like you to do is to take a deep breath. This is the moment when you can clap, stomp, cheer, whatever, for your candidate and thank them for their good work.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Daniels.